Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Hello and welcome to At That Age 12. This year, week we are doing a really Christmas special. And our Christmas special of the year is of course about Santa Claus or Saint Nicholas, the OG Santa Claus, if you will. Hence my Christmas hat here. And my guest this week is the Adam English, who has written The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. And of course that is Saint Nicholas. So first I'll try to get to know the author or the historian that I have on the podcast a little bit. So how did you come to study Saint Nicholas of all people?
Well, thank you so much, first of all, for having me on your podcast and your program. And I enjoy talking about this subject, and especially at this time of year. My own interest in Saint Nicholas came, well, from two places, really. I grew up at loving the traditions of Santa Claus and of Christmas and gift giving and all of that. But academically, my interest in Saint Nicholas came from my discovery of some archives in Italy. I typically lead a study abroad trip for students to Italy and discovered at one point that the remains of Saint Nicholas, the bones of Saint Nicholas, are in Bari, Italy, on the eastern coast of Italy. And that there's also an archive library there, in addition to a basilica with the bones and the tomb of St. Nicholas. So I had a chance to just go and spend some time there in the archive library and look at some of the sources. And, you know, my fascination with the original historical person of Nicholas just grew from there.
So how much do we actually know about St. Nicholas? Because, you know, there is... Saints always have this legendary, almost superhero-like stories of often that they have the super, some of them have the healing powers, some of them, you know, do this and that. That's almost unbelievable. Hence we call it this term the saint story. So how much is actually, not that it maybe necessarily matters, but how much do you actually know about a person, Saint Nicholas, than compared to the saint stories?
Yeah, it's messy. There's not an easy answer to that question because St. Nicholas himself did not leave any writings. And there are really no contemporaries of Nicholas that write about him either, or write to him or something like that. So everything we have about St. Nicholas comes after the fact. And so, you know, I certainly understand historians who will hold the life of St. Nicholas in some doubt. It would be much easier if we had, you know, something in his own handwriting or someone of that age who wrote about him. But the first stories that we have of Nicholas come really a couple of hundred years after his life. So, you know, now, does that mean that we don't trust them or that we don't believe them? Or no, you know, we can still find historical nuggets there that people who are writing about St. Nicholas were putting down in writing things that had been oral tradition and oral legend for a long time, and that many of them had some kind of historical basis. So certainly we have reason to believe that this real person really existed and did, you know, a number of things. There's no real reason to doubt that. But, you know, in terms of the hard, you know, practical evidence that we would love to have, especially for like a contemporary historical figure, you know, we don't have that. But of course, you remember that we're talking about someone who lived in the, you know, late 200s and early 300s. And so, you know, some of that we have to piece together and have some trust. But the earliest kind of real historical record that we have of Nicholas could be dated to about the year 500 or so.
So before we begin, what do you think of most people's connection to Saint Nicholas? Because I reckon everyone in the Christian world at least knows who he is, but they don't really know much about him. Do you think? So what do you think is everyone knows? Oh, the instant connection Saint Nicholas, that is Santa Claus, or the real Santa Claus. So, but do you think that's most what people think of him when they first hear the name? But what do you think is the most common perception with Saint Nicholas? Is there something there?
Yeah, you'd really have to separate out the, I guess, legendary or traditional Santa Claus from the, original historical Saint Nicholas. There is a line between them. There's a connection between them, but they really are different characters in some sense. Just that, Saint Nicholas became an extremely popular saint in the Middle Ages. Certainly. For a saint who is not in the Bible, so we're talking about extra biblical saints, he's probably one of the most popular saints in certainly in the Middle Ages. Just hundreds of churches named after him, lots of different little localities and towns that have Saint Nicholas traditions and Saint Nicholas legends. And then, of course, in the American context, which is very late, we're talking about the 1800s. There's a whole Santa Claus tradition that grows out of that. And there's this loose connection to the person of Saint Nicholas. But a lot of those, of course, are legendary and traditional and these sorts of things, family oriented. So, the connection is very loose. I think the connection is essentially that there was a bishop or a pastor. And that he did good works and he did acts of generosity, and then from that, people added on all kinds of, legends and stories and things like that. But yeah, there is a loose connection. But, for example, did he dress in a red fur coat and red fur hat and things like that? No, probably not. The dress of a bishop or a clergy member in the 300s probably would have been something really boring like black or brown or gray.
So let's begin with his early life because we do actually know when he was born in the 280s, but he does become orphan really quick. So let's talk about his parents' death and what he does after he become orphan and a little bit about his upbringing.
Sure. So the earliest sources tell us that Nicholas was raised in a Christian home. And so learned, the gospel faith from early on, learned the Christian tradition from early on, but that he lost his parents. We know of a plague that went through that area, and this is sort of on the southern coast of modern day Turkey. But we do know of a plague that went through that area around that time, and maybe he lost his parents in that way, and that he had inherited some amount of money. And so, as a young man, he had a The sources report that he had a deep faith and that he was, looking for, ways to impact his world. And of course, that gives us one of the most famous stories about Nicholas and the one that probably connects him most directly to Santa Claus and modern day Santa traditions. And of course, that's the story of the three dowries or the three young maidens. Just very quickly, that story is that he learns of a family in town. This is on Patara, on the southern coast of Turkey, the town of Patara. He learns of a family who has grown desperate, who have lost everything. A father who is, and of course, you remember at this time there were no credit cards or bank loans or things like that. So a man that goes into debt and goes into extreme poverty and is considering selling his daughters off into some sort of slavery or prostitution, which is extreme to be sure, but again, it's actually not something that is completely unknown. We have records of this sort of thing happening, at this time. And Nicholas decides to intervene, but not wanting to be recognized or known or called out for his act of generosity, he decides to act anonymously. And you know, this is the story then of Nicholas coming by in the middle of the night to drop off a bag of gold through the man's window. And the money is found in the morning. And as the story goes, you know, Nicholas is watching to see what they will do with the money. And as the story goes, the money is used as a dowry so that one of the daughters can marry out of her situation, out of poverty. And so Nicholas returns a second time with a second bag of gold, and the second daughter marries off. And then, as the story goes, on the third night, the third time that Nicholas delivers a bag of gold, the father is up and waiting. And when he hears the gold hit the floor, he runs out and grabs young Nicholas and turns him around and demands to know who he is. And Nicholas says, you know, I'll tell you, but on the condition that you can't tell anybody about this. And reveals himself to be Nicholas. You know, there's a lot about this story that obviously then connects to the Santa Claus story of a nighttime visitor, someone delivering gifts in the middle of the night
But it was not
anonymously,
through the chimney.
but not through the chimney. Yeah, I mean, the early stories have it through an open window. And then kind of later versions of the story say that Nicholas arrived and the windows were locked. And so he dropped the money down the chimney, you know, where it landed in a stocking that was hanging there by the fireplace drying. So you do have stockings and chimneys in later versions of the stories. But you know, again, that's you know, what do you make of that story historically? You know, how much truth is in it? It's hard to say, although two things that work in its favor. It's a fairly unknown type of story. It's not a typical saint story, or you know, it doesn't involve any kind of miracles. It's not a retelling of some other story that might make you think this is completely legendary. It seems like kind of a new story. And
It's plausible.
yeah, so there's a sense in which it's possible because it's not a miracle story, and it's not just a rehash of an older story that everybody already knows. And we have kind of from early murals and paintings on walls, you know, reproductions of this story on chapels and monastery walls and things like that. So it was a story that was known very early about Nicholas.
So let's talk about the next big thing that happens in Saint Nicholas' life, and that is Constantine decides to have the Council of Nicaea. And there is my understanding that we have to talk about, of course, the legend, their story that he supposedly punched another bishop in the face at the council. But there is also some debate, it's my understanding from listening to another podcast about Saint Nick, that there is was doubt, was he there or was he not there at the Council of Nicaea? So, what is your take on this? And so, let's talk a little bit about the Council of Nicaea.
Sure. For your audience, you know, the Council of Nicaea met in the year 325 and really is a watershed event in Christian history. So Constantine becomes the emperor of the entire Roman Empire, you know, kind of of the West and the East in 324, defeating Licinius. And, you know, one of the first thing he does is calls a council of Christian leaders, Christian bishops together to essentially, you know, they want to resolve a number of things, but essentially kind of resolve some of the questions and differences between the various branches of Christianity at this point. They meet in the town of Nicaea, which is just beneath what will be Constantinople. Constantine is reformulating the city of Byzantium to be the new Rome, which will be Constantinople. They're building, you know, capital buildings and palaces and things like that. And he takes up a temporary residence in the town of Nicaea. And so he's, you know, issues a letter for all bishops to attend. And they work out a number of things. You know, one is they work on the date of Easter. So some of it's just really practical stuff about trying to harmonize Christianity, trying to get some sort of, you know, consistent practice within the Christian church about the date
They
of
try to
Easter.
find out what Christianity should be like, what actually the
Yeah.
religion should be.
So some of it is that they're trying to say in a definitive way what something about the person of Jesus. So what is the relationship of Jesus Christ to God? And in what sense? So everybody that, I mean, this gets pretty technical, and I do apologize for that, but it's also important in the history of Christianity, because everybody, in the Christian world at that point certainly worshiped and acknowledged Jesus Christ as God's son, as divine. But there was some confusion or ambiguity about how divine is Jesus. Is Jesus the Son of God as divine as God the Father, or divine in some lesser way? So that's a really technical point, but the difference there is Christianity a monotheism? Is there just one God, expressed as God the Father and God the Son and God the Spirit? Or is Christianity something like a tritheism or a bitheism or something like that? Are there multiple gods? Is there God the Father? And then a little lower, is there God the Son? And then as different, is there God the Spirit? So really they're trying to figure out, is Christianity a monotheism with three expressions of God or a tritheism? So that's a pretty big thing to, to figure out. I mean, it's very technical, but it makes a huge difference if Christianity has one God or two or three gods. So that's what they were trying to figure out. Now, most, by and large, most people were on one side of this. We're on the kind of monotheistic side that the Father and the Son are the same essence and substance. But there was a minority opinion that said, no, I think that they are different. And that's the camp of Arius, and there were a couple of bishops there who represented that camp. Now, as far as Saint
And
Nicholas's,
I wanted to ask, well, to just to
yeah,
give a little
please.
bit background, what explain what Arianism was for those who may not be familiar with the term, as you mentioned. So let's give a little upswell background on and what Arianism was.
That's a good point to bring up. So, again, there were kind of three positions. I was going to maybe just say Nicholas is the reason we're talking about this is because we have evidence to suggest that Nicholas was at this council as a bishop of the time. His name appears in a number of lists of bishops who attended. So this is why, Nicholas comes into the story, because he was at this really important council. But
And
yeah, there
again,
was.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's also my understanding that there some of these lists were added later too. So that is something for instance where the debate comes in, whether he was there or not. Because it's my understanding that some of these were added later after the council to maybe put him in the Council of Nicaea to make it seem like he was there when he really wasn't. But so that is my
Yeah.
understanding there is some debate there among scholars.
There absolutely is. We'll get back to your question, your first question in just a second. But yeah, just to tie into that immediate point about was Nicholas there? As I understand it, there are about 16 lists of attendees that exist. There was nobody there at the time taking notes or taking a roll. So all of the lists come after, long after the council. We know for pretty much for a fact that there were about 300 bishops in attendance. So all of the lists that have at least 300 or more bishops in attendance, Nicholas is in those lists. But the lists that show a lot less than that, maybe like 100, 150, Nicholas's name is not in those lists. So his name is in some lists, but not in others. So the lists that are very small, maybe you think these are maybe just the most important bishops who were there. So Nicholas was not among them. But in terms of the comprehensive lists, the lists that have 300 or more bishops, Nicholas's name is there. So there's certainly still debate about whether to trust those lists or not. But again, I think if you start with the presumption that yeah, there were more than 300 bishops in attendance, Nicholas's name is in that list. Then you have some evidence to suggest he was there in person, and he was a bishop at that time, so he would have been expected to go for sure. Sorry, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold here, so I'll
That's
take a
fine.
little
Don't
drinks.
worry. You and me
A little
both.
croaky
That time of
sounding.
year again.
It's that time of year. So just to get back to your earlier question about Arianism, there were, it's again, about three positions at the council. Most people were in the first position or the first camp, and that was represented by Alexander and Athanasius of Alexandria. And this is what will become the Orthodox position. Basically, they answered the question, is the sun, excuse me, is the sun God in the same way that the Father's God? And they answered, yes, they are the same substance, the same essence. So they use that Greek term, homoousios, same substance. And then there was the Arian camp, represented by Arius and Arianism, which answered the question, is God, is the Son God in the same way that the Father's God? They answered, no. The Son is a different substance than the Father. You have God the Father, and then as a different substance, a different essence, God the Son, heterousios. Sorry. And then the third position was a mediating position. You have Eusebius of Nicomedia suggesting maybe we can compromise here, find a middle position, homoiousios. Maybe they are like substances or similar substances. Maybe the Father and the Son are kind of like each other in a similar sort of way.
Like father, like son.
Yeah, can we split the difference here? And as you may know, of course, then the ultimate decision of the council was to reject the compromise position and to reject Arianism, ultimately siding with Alexander and Athanasius of Alexandria in homoousios. And so they produced the Nicene Creed, a creedal statement, which has a long paragraph spelling out just what that means. So some famous language describing the Son as God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father. So they wanted to say as clearly as possible that as Christians, we worship one God, and that the Son is equal to God, 100% God. They are not different substances. They are not different essences. So Arianism has come to be known just simply as that belief that that in Christianity you have kind of two or three different kind of beings within God, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit as different essences. And the Orthodox Christianity simply says, that's too close to tritheism, and we can't go there.
Almost paganism in a sense.
Exactly. It's too close to paganism. That's not what we believe. And so that was shut down at the Council of Nicaea. But I
So let's
think
talk
that
about. Sorry, yeah.
Arianism is one of those, well, yeah, Arianism is one of those things that it was shut down, but it's still, it's still with us. I think it's still, as people just kind of naturally think about the Trinity, God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, people tend to explain it in their own minds in Arian ways. So Arianism, I think, is kind of a natural way to think about it. And it's not until you give it a lot of really hard thought that you end up rejecting Arianism and coming to something more orthodox. So anyways, that's all to say, yeah, it was dealt with at that time, but Arianism is something that never really went away.
So let's talk about the story where they say Nicholas punched. What was
Yeah.
the deal there? Not a punch, another bishop in at the
Good.
council. What was the deal?
Good. Yeah, let's circle back around to that. Thank you. Yes, so from what we can surmise, Nicholas was in attendance, but there were no records of what who said what. And so it doesn't seem to be the case that Nicholas really had much of a role there. But Nicholas became such a popular saint that people wanted to give him some role later, a legendary role. So it wasn't until the late 1300s that you have a new story about Nicholas starting to emerge. And in the first version of the story, Nicholas at the council hears, it's just called an Arian speaking heresy, and he's so zealous for his faith that he just, he can't take it, and so he gets up and punches this Arian, slaps him. And then later versions of that story will change it from just an Arian to Arius himself. And the problem is that because Nicholas has assaulted, physically assaulted someone in the presence of the Emperor Constantine, this cannot be tolerated. And so the bishops, or the other bishops present there, sanction Nicholas, essentially punish him by stripping him of his bishop's robes. They burn off his beard and they imprison him because of this act of violence that he's committed in front of the emperor. And as the story goes, Nicholas is languishing there in prison when Mother Mary and Jesus both come visit him in his prison. And to prove that, Nicholas was right, they restore his beard and they restore his, his clothing. And in the morning, when the bishops come and visit him and they see that his beard has been restored and his clothing are back on, they understand that Nicholas was defending the truth, defending orthodoxy. And so they let him out. Now, obviously, that is just a legendary story. It came very late in the tradition. It is n really no historical basis whatsoever. In
Not even
fact,
for Mary and Jesus showing up.
not even for Mary and Jesus showing up. No, I'm sorry to say. But it does give rise to a couple of things. Sometimes in artwork, medieval artwork, Nicholas is presented without his bishop's hat, without bishop's clothing. And that's kind of a reference to that story. So you see, like, a line of bishops, they all look like bishops except for Nicholas, who looks not like that. So it sometimes explains that. What I was going to say, it also gives rise to a number of great internet memes this time of year, internet pictures, people posting about Saint Nicholas punching, being holly and jolly, delivering gifts and punching heretics and that kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun. But there's another story, kind of connected with that, that will also sometimes show up in images. It's also said that when Nicholas confronted Arius, that he explained the Trinity to him by holding a brick, like a brick in his hand. And he said, God is like this brick. There's one God. And then, but made of three parts. You have the kind of the lime and the mud that go into the brick. You have the water that goes into the brick. And then all that gets fired. It gets heated and, baked into a single brick. So in this one brick, think of God that way. You have the Father, Son, and Spirit. You have the clay, the water, and the heat that form this one brick. And as Nicholas is explaining this, the brick bursts into flames, and water trickles out, and it reduces down to dust and water and mud and flames. So sometimes you'll see pictures of Nicholas holding a flaming brick, which is very strange from a, just a Santa Claus perspective. It does not make any sense. But that's the origin of that picture.
So you mentioned that we mentioned in the early on the story of the three girls, but and how it was not really this legendary magical saint story that usually combined with saints, and but of course Saint Nicholas as well does have some of these saint stories, and this happened a little bit before the 3 hour after, and I'm not don't remember, but the three sisters were the two boys are lured in to this man's house, and he murders them, and Saint Nicholas comes across them, and then he revives them. So there are as well others among where he goes to see and commands the waves to, kind of lie down, and the waves do so. So let's talk about some other Saint stories that are among these that are revolved, because of course there are have to be. It's not a saint without these magical stories. So let's talk about some of these Saint stories that surrounding Saint Nicholas.
There are so many other saint stories about Saint Nicholas. You know, as I mentioned, he's one of the most popular, maybe the most popular saint, certainly in medieval Europe. And of course, to this day, continues to be popular. It continues to be a patron saint of cities and countries and
Of Santa
people
Claus.
and Santa Claus, right? So, yeah, just endless stories about Saint Nicholas. One of the most famous legendary stories is the one that you mentioned at the beginning, about Nicholas resurrecting three boys back to life. And that story does not really have a connection to the dowry story. That story seems to come from a different story altogether, historical story about Saint Nicholas rescuing three military officers from prison. And there's kind of a long story about how that gets connected to it. But in the early Middle Ages, as people, around the year 1000, 1100s, somewhere right in there, as you have different theater troupes going from town to town producing theatrical dramas, Nicholas stories were among the first non-biblical Christian-based, stories that they did. Of course, a lot of times they would go town to town and do, maybe a Bible story, a theatrical production of a Bible story, or maybe just some kind of local other kind of story. But Nicholas stories became very popular to reproduce, and this was certainly one of them. And the story is goes that three young boys, and there are different versions of it. Sometimes they're seminarians or but three young boys basically stop in at an inn, a little motel, and need lodging for the night, and that the innkeeper comes in the middle of the night and I guess robs the boys basically, but then also kills them and butchers them up and stuffs them into pickling barrels. And then shortly thereafter, Nicholas arrives and, asks for a place to stay, asks for something to eat, and, asks the innkeeper directly about maybe he could get some pickled herring or some kind of pickled meat. And at that point, forces the innkeeper to confess about these murders. And then Nicholas goes and resurrects the boys out of the barrels. In other versions of the story, it's a butcher, which makes a little more sense, right? Why would an innkeeper butcher these boys? But maybe it was a meat butcher who cut up the boys.
Almost a little Sweeney Todd story there.
Yes. So it's a detective story. And, that makes Nicholas a detective. So, yes, a lot of pictures that people will see, old-timey pictures of Nicholas is him standing over barrels with of three maybe naked boys coming out of the barrels, and it's really strange, like why are these children coming out of the barrels? He's bringing them back to life, and it's kind of a strange scene unless you know that backstory, and then it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But again, that one does not seem to have any sort of direct connection to a historical event. It's connected to a different historical story about Nicholas rescuing three military officers out of prison by appearing in a dream. But it doesn't have anything to do with them coming out of a pickling barrel or being resurrected to life.
So let's talk about this death. And as you mentioned earlier on in Bari, how this archive for St. Nicholas there, and that how his body is supposedly laying there, in not in Turkey at the present. And to give a little bit of background, saints like such as St. Nicholas, because it was canonized quite fast after his death. And saints were pretty much rock star or celebrities, movie stars of the medieval ages. Everyone wants, and at the end of the day, everyone wants a memorabilia or a souvenir of something that a celebrity has worn, a shoe or whatever they can get their hands on, basically. Some people are like this. And but the people who took Saint Nicholas' body, they took it to a whole nother level where they took the entire body supposedly and took it back to Saint to Bari in Italy. So they took this kind of memorabilia a little bit to the next level, to put it this way. So, but how did they come across Saint Nicholas' body and bring it to Bari, where supposedly, and do you have any evidence that this is actually Saint Nicholas' body and corpse that's supposedly lays there?
Yeah, in the Middle Ages, saints' relics were a major business, a major commodity, a major thing that people were interested in. So every church, every chapel had some kind of relic, and where people were
Or the
looking for
true
relics.
cross.
Yeah, that's right. So the bones of Saint Mark were taken from Alexandria to Venice, and bones were sometimes stolen or purchased, and when they were moved, they were called translated, as opposed to saying they were stolen or they were just moved. So they were translated from one place to another. But everybody was looking for some kind of special saint to have in their chapel or their church or their place. At this time, Turkey, where Myra, where Nicholas was buried, had been, taken over by the Seljuk Turks, and Christians were losing the ground there, and had been for a long time. And so there was some feeling that the bones of Saint Nicholas were vulnerable, that they might be destroyed by the Muslims who took possession of the town, or that they might just be lost forever. And so a number of groups, the Venetians included, were planning to take the bones, and move them to safety, or just, relocate them. Sailors from Bari arrived first with the plan, and so they went into the Church of Saint Nicholas, where he was buried there in Myra, Turkey, which is today Dimra, Turkey, and found the tomb of Saint Nicholas, broke into it, and then scooped out the bones and brought them back to Bari. Short time after that, some sailors from Venice arrived in Myra and scooped out the remaining little fragments of bones. So there are some bone fragments also in a church at Lido, in outside of Venice. And then there the most of them, though, are in Bari, Italy.
Have there been done DNA tests on the body or such that they can confirm that this is indigenous? So some have on certain sculptures that have both been disproven and approved of the, so this type of kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, proving with total certainty that these are the bones of Nicholas would be probably almost impossible. We have firsthand accounts of the raid on Myra and the stealing of these bones, the taking of these bones. So we have people who were there at the time who talked about what happened. We certainly believe the story that they stole bones from Myra, from this church. Now, to your question, how do we know that they stole the right bones? That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you. I don't know. Even if you did a DNA test, I don't know that what it would prove. We don't have Nicholas's original DNA to match it against, right? So to this day, yes, the if you talk to like the Turkish archaeologists, they will, sometimes you'll have people who disagree and say, no, they about every year, if you just watch the news, there's some news story coming out of Turkey, and the archaeologists say, oh, no, they didn't steal the actual bones. There are different bones that have not been stolen, and that are actually still here. And who knows? I mean, it's a lot of back and forth, but we can trust that in 1084, that sailors from Bari actually took actual bones from the church at Myra that they believed to be Saint Nicholas and moved them back to Bari. And there's ongoing excavations of the church in Myra, of different tombs and things like that. But again, at this point, just about all of them have been broken into and raided and just, compromised in a lot of ways.
Did you see the bells yourself when you were in Bari in the archive?
So the bones are buried kind of in a sarcophagus, so they're not on display.
Hmm.
So you can see the tomb of Saint Nicholas, but not the bones themselves. In the late 1960s, early 1960s, excuse me, the sarcophagus was opened, and pictures were taken of the bones, and they did some surveys of them and measurements and things like that. But yeah, you can't see the physical bones for yourself, just the tomb.
So let's talk about the trend on how, because the Czechs really do seem to love Saint Nicholas. They have Saint Hol the holidays dedicated and parties to him. So let's talk a little bit about the Czech, devotion to Saint Nicholas, because they really seem to love, it's my understanding, and do love the saints.
Now, you're referring to the check you said, or the
The
say that
Czech,
again.
yeah. The Czech does seem to love the, according to Dr. Eleanor Janiger, there is on her podcast interview, there was seemed to be that I do really love to have festivities in December, and the December 5th, there is this really big holiday dedicated to and party dedicated to Saint Nicholas on this Saint day. So they do seem to be quite devoted to Saint Nicholas.
Yes, especially in Europe and in many different parts of Europe, there are many different celebrations and festivals of Saint Nicholas to this day. Among the Dutch and the Spanish and certainly the Czech and the Swedish and so it's just the British, just about everybody, the French have some kind of celebration. Most of them happen December 5th. Or six. So December 6 is Saint Nicholas Day. And so a lot of times on the 5th, the day before, there's a really big Saint Nicholas celebration, gift exchange, family meals, parades, that sort of thing. But yeah, each different region or area has their own particular traditions. Now, a lot of the world has been influenced by the American Santa Claus, which is more about the December 24th and 25th. So a lot of times, they integrate both the old tradition, Saint Nicholas traditions, and the new Santa Claus traditions. But yeah, it's, to this day, very popular.
So let's talk about how the modern Santa Claus came to be, from Saint Nicholas, and of course Coca-Cola is kind of the obvious answer, but how a little bit about the tradition before Coca-Cola came in, because it wasn't always that the red and white comes from Coca-Cola, but let's talk about how it came to America and how Saint Nicholas became what we know as Santa Claus today.
Okay, sure. Saint Nicholas' transformation to Santa Claus, it really happens in the early 1800s, and it's a kind of the combination of two things, commercialization and domestication, if you will. The person of Saint Nicholas is commercialized. That is to say, he's used in commercials for department stores and advertisements to sell merchandise because he's a gift giver. And so at the holiday season, when you want to choose a gift, having Saint Nicholas help you choose that gift or endorse a gift is really helpful. But also a product of domestication. So in the early 1800s, especially in the American tradition, but even in parts of Europe, December is a time of partying, celebrating, carousing, being out on the streets. much more like maybe New Year's Eve, where there's just a lot of party and stuff like that. And especially in the city of New York, as they're looking for ways to try to limit some of the partying and some of the, I guess, the rowdier aspects of Christmas, they begin introducing Santa Claus, Saint Nicholas, as a figure who appears in homes and transforming Christmas from a big outdoor celebration into a domestic celebration, something that happens inside the house. Saint Nicholas coming to visit homes and play with children and deliver gifts to children and things like that. So you kind of have two forces happening at once, the force of commercialization, which, again, creates this commercial Santa, who gets depicted as, a jolly elf, with a smile and a friendly beard and, his red suit, but also a domestic character. He's now somebody that is welcome in the home and, is going to be trusted with children and things like that. So that's kind of the origins of that transformation from Saint Nicholas, this kind of wild medieval figure, into the modern Santa Claus. And of course, to do that, you end up losing a lot of sort of the religious connection. So you think about the Santa Claus figure in the red cape and, white fur trim and black belt. You can see, if you really look hard at it, you can sort of see how that suit evolved from a bishop's robes and bishop's hat and bishop's attire. But it's all been softened and it's lost its religious look to it. There aren't crosses on it or anything that would connect it to, a Christian priest or bishop, right? So
How did he end up on the North Pole of all places?
that happened in the early late 1800s, early 1900s. People at that time were just fascinated by the North Pole. There were expeditions to the South Pole and to the North Pole, and it was just a popular thing to imagine and think about the Northern Lights and to think about, life at the North Pole, life at the South Pole, and who on earth could live in such a place, an inhospitable place. And so it's kind of became like a magical place. And so why not put Santa Claus there, Saint Nicholas there, because he also has kind of this magical, mystical connection. He moves and he's dressed in this heavy red fur attire, so he has to live somewhere cold. Him living in Turkey no longer makes sense.
Canada would have been quite cold as well, so that could have been the place as any.
And there were a lot of expositions into Canada, so he could live there. So yeah, I think it was just, there's nothing specific that says, aha, here's the logical reason to put him at the North Pole. But just kind of one of those things that sort of started to make sense in people's minds. In Finland, there are other, as you may know, there are other kind of legends about the home of Saint Nicholas being someplace in Finland. And so different people have different ideas. I mean, it's a mythical character, so you can put him anywhere you want.
Of course, we are going to run out now, but before we go, I've got to ask, do you have any favorite Santa Claus song and a Santa Claus movie that you watch every year, or that's your personal favorite?
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's good. I really enjoy the movie Elf, with Will Ferrell. It's just a I think it's just funny. And but yeah, there's so many good movies and then holiday songs. Up on the housetop, Old Saint Nick is a good a fun song. I
Cool
don't
You
for
is a pretty good one by that's gonna be one of my favorite by I don't remember his name lost me right now, but Cool You is one of my favorites at Santa Claus. Is that going to the Santa Claus song?
Yeah, what is your favorite movie, or is it?
Oh, is this a fairly recent one? It's an animation. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but Klaus is a it's a lovely little film. I really enjoy that one. So that one is definitely a favorite, and I don't say that 94 version. I don't think I've seen the original of Miracle on 43rd Street. It's really a great Santa Claus film as well. That's gonna be one of
Yes.
my top two at least.
Oh, that's great. And is there a, for Norway, is there a particular song that you sing this time of year?
There are a few, but I don't have them on my top of my head at the moment. But it's easy to look up if you just do the Norwegian Christmas songs. It should be fairly easy to look up. But there are I don't really listen to much Norwegian Christmas songs. But again, thank you so much for
Yes,
coming
thank
on the
you.
podcast. Before you go, do you have any social media, any links you wanted to put in the description, or where can people buy your book? The
Sure.
book, right?
Yeah.
If you want to read about Saint Nicholas and the real man behind Santa Claus, if they wish to read further. And of course, it's a perfect Christmas gift for this time of year, so why not give it out as a Christmas gift if you are interested?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. You can get it on Amazon. .com or just anywhere you buy books. It's published by Baylor University Press, so it could be easy to find. But yeah, we just scratched the surface of it, so there's much more.
And again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you. This has been That Aged Well. We are available on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts. If you are on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a review and give us 5 stars. That would help us out a lot. If you are on Spotify, consider giving us 5 stars there as well. If you are on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. We have also recently joined Threads under That Aged Well. We are on Twitter/X. Well, that is well, Instagram, same. Please like, share, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time. Also, before I go, please check out some other Christmas specials we made. We made such as the Christmas Truce of 1914, The Origin of Christmas from Early On Until Modern Times, and Saturnalia Christmas, and of course, most recent on Saint Nicholas, which you heard today. My name is Alan, and I'll see you next time.